Hello and welcome to the program. You can visit the website anytime you like, rte.ie/Mooney. Happy 4th of March to everybody listening in today. We've got a very busy show ahead of us tonight. We've got a terrific story about an abseiling slug coming up for you. Later we'll be talking to Terry Flanagan about swans and why the cygnets aren't leaving home. Sound familiar? Cygnets are the young swans, just in case you're wondering. They're staying longer with the parents, it seems. Well, in one case at any rate, we'll discover more about that later on. But let's begin by introducing our panel. We've got Richard Collins at his home in Malahide and Niall Hatch at his home in Greystones. But first, attention, por favor! Niall Hatch, you're just back from Spain. How was it? What were you doing there?
That's right, yes. Had a lovely time in the region of Extremadura, one of the best bird watching areas in all of Europe. I had a great time watching steppe birds, lots of birds of prey as well. So many vultures, just mind-blowing. Great place.
Excuse my ignorance, Niall, but what are steppe birds?
Birds that live on open plains, so this steppe type habitat, as in S-T-E-P-P-E. So birds like the great bustard, the little bustard, the pintailed sand grouse, the black-bellied sand grouse, species that are like these big open expanses of short grassland in sort of very arid kind of conditions, semi-desert almost. So it's a habitat we don't have too much of in Europe, but Extremadura, which is in the very west of Spain, just near the Portuguese border, it doesn't have any coast, it's totally inland, which means that it's subject to lots of seasonal variations in temperature. In the winter it's quite cool, but in the summer it gets very, very hot indeed, up to 45 degrees. And those birds are actually very well evolved to be able to survive in those in those conditions. The sand grouse, for example, which are not grouse at all, they're more like pigeons, although they're really quite a unique group of birds. They're so well adapted to life in such arid conditions that the adult birds have absorbent belly feathers. And what they do is they'll fly dozens of kilometres sometimes to find a watering pool during the summer. Mm-hmm. They'll stand in it and the water actually soaks up like a sponge into their feathers.
Yeah.
They fly back to the nest and the little chicks come and they actually suck the water directly out of their parents' bellies from those feathers. That's how well adapted they are. That rough
life. That's incredible. Have you ever seen anything like that, Richard?
Yes, I have. I've been to central Spain. It is a wonderful place and the birds of prey are all over the place.
Now, as I have two birders here, I have an interesting question for you. It's something I had observed recently, but had never seen before in my 57 years on this planet. I was out for a walk in Fairview, and I noticed some pigeons. And as I got closer to the pigeons, which were pecking something or other off the ground, one of them started walking backwards and pecking. All right, so picture the scene. What's the big deal? Well, I've never seen a bird walk backwards in my life, Niall Hatch.
Yes, it is kind of unusual. Birds tend to go forwards because that's what their eyes are best at seeing. Having said that, pigeons have their eyes set very far in the sides of their heads, so it's almost like having 360-degree vision. And I could see how, if the need arose, they could actually walk backwards and they could still see where they're going. So it wouldn't be their preference, but if they're, you know, if rather than turn around, if they're trying to find food or sometimes during their breeding displays, which we're seeing now at this time of the year already, they will do that. So yeah, it's certainly unusual, but birds have a much more all-round vision than we do, so it's actually easier for them than it would be for us. They can see where they're going, more or less.
So it's not a big deal.
Well, it's certainly unusual. As you said, you remarked on it, it's the first time that you've seen it. I'm just trying to rack my brain to see how many times I've seen birds walk backwards. I have seen some types of bird in Central America called manakins, which do this amazing dance, this display. People may have seen it on some nature programs on television, where they do this almost like the moonwalk backwards. It's this lovely tiny little black bird with a red and yellow head, and they sort of walk to this backwards sliding walk, very much like the Michael Jackson moonwalk. And that's a bird that's moving backwards as part of its display. I think that some of the birds of paradise in New Guinea, which I've never had the privilege of seeing with my own eyes, but some of them walk backwards as part of their breeding displays too. So it is something the birds can do. And I suppose, though, with most birds, the way their feet are designed, with the vast majority of the toes pointing forward, just one toe pointing backwards, the general direction of travel would be forwards. So it makes sense that they would normally do that.
Now, by the time I got my phone out to record this, it had stopped and started walking forwards again. In fact, it had flown away. So I was raging, but it was something I noticed. Richard, anyway.
Derek, yes, I believe I am the person in Ireland that has seen more birds walk backwards than anyone else. The reason, I spent years jousting with swans, that is, trying to catch swans to put rings on their legs. And the big male swans would rear up in front of you, and you would rear up in front of them. They're expecting you to run away, and you don't. When you step forward, they will often step back. Yes, but they have an advantage, remember? They can swivel the head around. They have almost 360-degree vision as it is, but by turning the head, a bird with a long neck can turn its head and see what's behind it. The problem with walking backwards, as you and I know, it's a dangerous thing to do. But if you're a bird that can see behind as well as in front, it is immaterial. Now, in the whole range of birds, there is one that is said not to be able to walk backwards. Mm-hmm. And it is the emu of Australia.
Okay, why?
Now, that is one of the questions of ornithology. No, you could check this, by the way, because they used to have, I know if they still have, emus in Foto Wildlife Park. So the keepers there could tell you whether they've seen it walk backwards in the park. But that's an aside. Now, it is very unusual, it seems to me, because an emu has a long neck and can check out what's behind it. But it's also a great runner. And it can run fast and long distances. It's the only bird with calf muscles to aid it in doing that. Ostriches, for instance, can walk backwards. So it's interesting that the emu is a little bit different. Now, walking is a rather strange thing. Left, right, left, right. Starlings walk when they're feeding. Thrushes and things tend to hop more than walk. Now, what do penguins do? Well, they kind of waddle. They shift their centre of gravity and have to put a foot forward to prevent themselves falling, or a foot backwards to prevent themselves falling. So is that really walking? But I'm quibbling a little bit about that, aren't I? Among the other animals, of course, alligators and crocodiles move along on their belly most of the time. I'm told they don't slide backwards. Maybe they do, but I'm told they don't. But they have another thing called the high walk. That is when they lift up onto all fours. Mm. They can be remarkably fast and dangerous if they come at you on all fours, because they can run forward. Now, they're able to do all kinds of manoeuvres when standing, their belly clear of the ground, rushing forward towards you or backing off from you. In Australia, I remember being in swampy places where there were notices up to be very careful, because the crocodiles can come out suddenly and rush at you and pull you in. Not the kind of death I would relish. Anyway, I'm getting away from the birds.
That's very interesting about the emu there, Richard. And I think there probably is something to that. Their legs are so well designed for running forwards with those calf muscles, as you mentioned, that the actual locomotion going backwards just probably wouldn't work. It's a mechanical thing, really. Most birds, when they move, what they do is they use a system of tendons. And that's why birds have such slender legs. You don't see muscles in their legs at all. The muscles that are controlling their toes and the forward locomotion are all up towards the top of the leg and inside their body. So the exposed part of the leg, you don't see them. But on an emu, you do. It's got a very different structure. And we know that emus are a very primitive type of bird. When we talk about how birds and dinosaurs are really the same thing, how birds came from the dinosaurs. When you look at an emu, you can really see it. It looks like a dinosaur more than a bird, really. So from that point of view, it makes a lot of sense. And with birds, of course, they're designed to go forwards. Everything about their life is swimming forwards or flying forwards or walking or running forwards. And while many birds possibly can go backwards, I'd say they can't do it very quickly. It's just the way that their legs are designed, the whole musculature and the tendons efficient to do it that way.
That is absolutely extraordinary. I will never, boys, look at birds' legs again the same way. I've never thought about the lack of muscles on the legs. I mean, that's very interesting. Thank you, Niall and Richard. And by the way, Richard, you mentioned swans. Terry Flanagan and yourself were out looking at swans, I know, not so long ago. And Terry's in studio now, which seems a tiny bit odd. Terence, that you're sitting here, Richard's at home, and we're about to play a report of you and Richard. So why? What's it all about?
I was out on the canal on my own, not with Richard, and I was walking the dog and I saw two swans on the canal. Now, that's not uncommon, except one of them was an adult swan, a female, and the other was a young swan, one of last year's. And I thought to myself, there's an awful lot of white in that baby swan. And I always had the feeling that when the baby swans develop the white colour, which is generally around September, October, that the parents drive them off the territory. But here was a female and a baby swan, almost an adult swan. I couldn't figure out why this baby would still be with the mother. So who better to find out more than Richard Collins.
And where did you go?
I went off with Richard to the Broadmeadows in North County Dublin, a place I know that is close to his heart and where there are lots and lots of swans.
Right. Welcome to the best swan flock on the East Coast. I think it's the best swan flock the whole way, isn't it? If you go to Wexford, you might get a bigger one. But
they're beautiful, aren't they?
They're gorgeous, yes.
I knew I'd find you close to the swans. Yeah. And you know what? The reason I'm here today is I want to talk to you about swans. Because
good.
Up on the canal, where you were with me when we did the Christmas show, there are a pair of swans. I have it here on the phone. I'm going to let you have a look at this here now as I'm chatting to you.
Yes, these are a pair of swans. Very well filmed, may I say. The pro, you're a pro. Go on.
Well, if you look at it, you'll see
yes.
One is an adult, the one behind that's swimming along there. And the one in front seems to me to be a young bird, seems to be last year's young. Would I be right in saying that?
That's right. It's got a lot of brown plumage on it. Yeah. They lose the plumage gradually over the year and they're pure white. Well, not pure white for a while. There'll be still some brown on the rump maybe next year.
Yeah.
But they get whiter.
Well, I always thought that once the adult birds, once they see some white appearing on the young bird, that it's time to drive them away.
Yeah, Daddy gets angry with these teenagers when they're not dressed properly. You know, they're the wrong haircut and, you know, they've things dangling from their noses and things of that kind. So Daddy gets very cross as they get white and he becomes more and more uneasy about them. And eventually he'll drive them out. You know, just say, get the hell out of here. Want you here anymore. I'm disappointed in you. That's the sort of sentiment. Mainly him. She might do it to some extent, but he is the driving force. No, he has to do that, Terry. He has to do it. It's all about paying the bill. Because she will now, from now on, if she's going to breed next year, she'll have to form eggs. She'll have to build up eggs. And in a good territory, there may be as many as 9 eggs, or even more sometimes. And it takes a lot of energy, a lot of food to provide that. And there's got to be enough water, area, territory of water defended to provide that food, water weeds. And that's a tall order. He's got to reserve an awful lot of it, keep other swans out. And that's going to be his wife and children's food for the next season. But if he doesn't drive last year's swans out, he's saddled with too many swans eating up the food. So he's got to clear the decks for next year's brood.
Well, I walk this section of the canal regularly, every day in fact, from anywhere between Castle Lock right up to Leixlip. If I walk with the dog. And these two swans that we see here, this adult, which is a female, I think. But I've never seen the male, the daddy, so to speak. So I'm thinking this is last year's mammy and the young bird. Would you agree with that?
Yeah. Well, yes, it's possible. Remember, when youngsters are out, they get white, they're ousted. Now, they then have to, if they're wandering about, having been kicked out of the territory, the youngsters tend to, if they see swans, they attempt to join them. And this is their natural instinct. So it could be, it's hard to know, you can't tell too much from just this observation. But it may be a youngster, there's two possibilities. It may be a youngster that has seen this female on the canal and has decided to join her. As females tend to be less aggressive and it might get away. But I suspect that this is actually a pair, or not a pair, but a mother and child.
And why?
Because if you look at the video, she is coming after it. She's coming after the baby.
Bird. Yeah.
And that suggests a kind of maternal care for the youngster, calling it back, kind of. But I'm reading into it now. I mean, I don't know this, you know. But the signet is coming over towards us a bit, hoping for a handout of bread or something from us, probably. And she's kind of holding back and saying, come be careful now, don't go to those two, they're a dangerous-looking pair, don't go near them. That suggests that they are related in some way. It may not be true, but that is the likely.
Yeah, no, that's exactly what I thought. And I have seen people down here in this spot feeding the swans. But I just don't understand why they haven't driven or why the mammy hasn't driven this one away. Is it common for young birds to stay with the parents over winter?
Well, first of all, it may not be a territory. You and I have walked that stretch of canal, and I don't remember any nests I have seen out there.
Now, there are very, very few nests on the Royal Canal.
Canals were, I suspect, a lot of cases that I've managed to show this anyway, that the canals were dug, quarries were dug, for the stones to line the canal, do you see? So the quarries are much better places in which the swans could nest. 100 metres away or 200 metres away from the canal itself, you'll get the pair on the quarry. They won't be disturbed there so much. There'll be lots of weed and so on for them to feed on. And then when the adults have their youngsters, they move them onto the canal. So you tend not to get nests on the canal for that reason. You do get some nests on the canal, it's not, but they're often struck by barges and things like that. So this might be what's happening here, that she's not actually defending a territory. She may have moved onto the canal and is now kind of free of the property problem to some extent. Yeah.
What do you think might have happened, the cob, the daddy?
I wouldn't necessarily think there's anything has happened. The cob might have other signals back on a quarry somewhere. That's one possibility. Swans are very vulnerable flying. So if it's flying along the canal, the likelihood of death is quite high. Mm-hmm. It's a risky business flying when you're a swan, and about half of them are killed crashing into wires, you see. So he might be dead. He may not be dead. He may be holding territory back home. And she may be on an excursion along the canal. Mm-hmm. But, you know, there are all kinds of possibilities. But she's not aggressive towards this youngster, as far as I can see from this video.
No, she seems actually to be protective of it.
Yes, yes. I would say a mother and daughter situation. But one doesn't speak ex cathedra about these things. It might be that. And they can sometimes, the cygnets stay rarely with the parents on through the following season, and it's in the second year that they depart.
Really?
Yes, yeah. I've seen that once or twice. It was very rare. I remember one extraordinary case where the cob swan stayed on, a young cob, a young male, stayed on for years. And the pair continued to breed. This particular male had an injury and couldn't fly properly. The owners of the territory tolerated this extra cob for a while, and eventually, for 3 or 4 years, it was there at the far end of the territory, and they just ignored it. They say, sure, he's harmless.
So what explanation then would you give for these two swans?
I think this female has drifted from a territory that's off the canal somewhere onto the canal, and she's now proceeding around with it. The cob is back home, and they probably have 3 or 4 more cygnets, and he's staying back minding the house, you know. I think that might be the explanation.
And some pictures on the website, rte.ie/Mooney. Thank you very much indeed, Terence Flanagan. Now, Michelle Brown, our researcher, has popped in with some questions for the guys. Michelle?
Hi, Derek. Hi, guys. How are you? A few emails in from people around the country saying about the robins, Niall, that they're all saying the robins are getting on very well in their gardens. So that's taken quite a bit of interest around that.
Now, you've got to remind people, that goes back to an email from somebody who said they had 2 robins in the garden and they wanted to know, was this unusual? And were they already pairing off? This is a couple of weeks ago, Niall.
That's right, and I think that's what's going on. If it's recently people are seeing 2 robins together in a garden, that's because love is in the air. They're getting ready for the breeding season. They may already be nesting at this stage. Robins can often nest quite early, especially if conditions are mild and enough food is around. So that's probably why they're tolerating each other at the moment. I still stand by what I was saying about robins being very territorial, even in the winter, and it's very unusual for that détente to remain intact throughout the entire year, for the whole 12 months. Usually towards the end of the summer, those relationships break down, the robins go their separate ways and become very aggressive again. So that's normal behaviour for a robin, is to not very tolerant of other robins except when they have to propagate the species. So for the next few weeks, the next few months indeed, you may see robins cooperating, the male and female together, but it's just a temporary thing, I'm afraid.
Okay. And also, you'll be happy to hear now that Catherine Natala was on. Remember, she sent a video of her blue tits reacting to the reflection in the mirrors, and she said they covered the mirror.
Catherine said that she had, and showed us a video of the blue tit which was attacking its own image. She has a mirror on one of the partition walls in our back garden, and we suggested that she covers it up, put plants in front of it, put a cover over it. But whatever you do, stop the bird from seeing itself, because at this time of year they're getting territorial and they're seeing each other. So it seems to have stopped, which is good news, Niall.
It is, absolutely. So again, because of breeding behaviour this time of year, the blue tits and other birds are getting very aggressive as well. When they see their reflection in a mirror, or very often in a pane of glass, we get lots of inquiries into the show and into Birdwatch Ireland about this as well at this time of year, blue tits pecking at windows. Mm. It's because they're seeing their own reflection. They think it's a rival encroaching on their territory. It can drive them absolutely nuts. The key to it, if you have that problem with blue tits coming to your window panes or whatever, what you can do is if you get some cling film, You scrunch it up so it's very, very wrinkled, and then put it loosely over the outside of the pane of glass. So don't stretch it tight. You want it to be as wrinkled as possible. Those wrinkles then break up the reflection so that the bird no longer recognizes it, and they soon lose interest. And you'll need to have it there for a couple of weeks. The bird will then forget all about this rival and go on with their breeding.
All right. Jonathan was on as well, saying he noticed house martins. Then he's wondering, were they swallows back in the nest over their front door? He sent a video in 6th of February. He thought it was exceptionally early, and he's wondering, is it?
Okay, so it's a video of a bird, and he thinks it's a house martin, and he wants to rule out the fact that it's not a swallow. So swallows won't really nest around the eaves. They do nest in barns, Niall.
That's right. So swallows will nest inside a structure. They build a nest mainly of mud, though bits of grass and straw in it. And it's a cup-shaped thing that goes usually inside a shed or a barn or a porch, something like that. House martins are the ones that make the nest entirely out of mud underneath the eaves of a house. That's the one on the outside wall. So when people have them nesting up, you know, under the eaves or under the gutters, it's almost always house martins that are doing that. Now, I've had a look at the video that was sent in there by Jonathan, and it would indeed be extremely early for house martins to be back in Ireland and nesting and returning to their nests, almost impossibly early. The bird actually in the video, it's neither a house martin nor a swallow. It's actually a house sparrow. So I've seen it there perching up on the roof of the house in the video and then going into the house martin's nest. And actually house sparrows are very well known for doing this. They're resident in Ireland. They stay with us year round, and they'll prospect for nest sites very early in the year, long before the swallows or the house martins are back. And they're well known for taking over house martin nests. Sometimes get the two species side by side in a colony, the house martin having taken over an old nest by a house martin. But sometimes what they'll do is the house sparrow will even evict house martins from the nest. They're a bit more aggressive, a bit more of a bully, and they'll actually kick them out of the nest. So in this case, what it is, it's not a house martin, it's a house sparrow that's in the nest.
Can I ask you a question with regard to the house martin? We've also got the sand martin, which comes here to breed, and it chooses to build its nest in, well, the clue is in the name, sand banks. But why doesn't the house martin do the same thing? How have they evolved like this, one to go to the eaves of houses and the other to go to sandbanks? Because if you go back far enough, surely there weren't houses, there weren't structures like that around. There was all kind of sandy banks, if you know what I mean.
Yes, absolutely. And the thing is that house martins must have benefited massively from human buildings over the last few centuries, particularly over the last couple of millennia, let's say. Before that, we're not really fully sure where they nested. It's thought it must have been in cliffs and overhangs and cliffs, maybe branches on trees, but they pretty much changed completely now to human buildings. So they're all only really found on human structures. So their behaviour has completely changed. So one of the birds that's benefited from development would be the house martin. The sand martin is much less reliant on humans. As you said, they nest in sandy banks along rivers, sometimes very very sandy cliff faces as well. They can excavate a tunnel into, and it's millions of years of evolution.
The fact is they
each find their own niche. It's all about reducing competition and finding a space for yourself where no other bird or other creature is competing with you. So in this case, it works out very well. They can separate their breeding areas completely, and yet still you'll find them together in mixed flocks feeding, because they eat the same food. They eat small flying insects, so you often see them gathering, particularly over water or high in the sky in the summer, hoovering up all these insects along with the swallows, along with the swifts, which are unrelated birds, completely unrelated, but have evolved a very similar lifestyle. And they only nest inside attic spaces and roof, but behind roofs and so on. So it's completely different again. So it's a way of they're reducing competition. They eat the same food, but they nest in different places.
Richard.
My nearest bird neighbours are in fact sand martins, about 100 metres from my door. They excavate a series of holes. Interestingly, there are beautiful holes in the seawall, but they ignore them largely, and they excavate new ones in the grassy slope above it. And people pass along it back and forth. Hundreds of people pass back and forth within 2 or 3 metres of them. Most people don't see them, but they are there, and they're there every year. Now, they're usually the first to arrive. Why are they doing that as opposed to nesting in houses? Well, I suspect that where I live, the insect community on which they feed is different from the insect community on which swallows, say, or house martins inland would be feeding on. So there's specialisation here. These have honed their skills on marine insects close to the coast, I suspect. And I think that is what is going on in here. The first to arrive every year, sand martins. The next to arrive, 2 weeks later maybe, swallows. Now, they don't nest right where I am. And finally, the house martin. He's the last to come, usually. Now, he does sometimes nest in the house behind me, but it's a hit and miss thing.
Any more there, Michelle?
Hi, Derek. I live in Leaslip. My bird feeder has been taken by something. The low-down branches of my laburnum were broken. My feeder is gone. I've looked all over the garden, but no sign. This happened twice last year, and this is the second time this year. Could it be a mink or a weasel? I don't want to give up feeding the birds. Any advice? Please help. I listen every Monday, and that's from Mary.
Mary, well, I can tell you a story. Are you ready for this, Michelle? Are you ready, Niall and Richard? Are you ready for a story?
Of course, always.
Well, Fido, when I was working for the BBC Natural History Unit, we made a film for a series called Nature Detectives about people and nature and their relationship with nature. People would contact us and tell us, I've got this in my garden, or I saw this when I was out for a walk, or can you identify this creature? Anyway, this man contacted us to say that he had a badger feeding from a hanging feeder. Nobody believed him, but he sent in evidence of the badger climbing up on a trellis, hanging onto the trellis and kind of reaching and stretching out, if you could imagine it, pulling the hanging feeder over and taking the nuts out. Now, we wouldn't have believed it if we hadn't seen it with our own eyes. I'm not saying that's what's happening here, but is it impossible?
Not impossible at all, but I would suspect the local cats rather than badgers, but that's just...
Oh, well, I'm not saying it was a badger. I'm just giving you an example because she asked if it was a mink or a weasel, you see.
We can definitely rule out a weasel because we don't have weasels in Ireland. We have a stoat. Now, sometimes the stoat is colloquially known as the weasel. But no, we don't have weasels, which are tiny creatures. We have the stoat, which is also very small. Mary mentioned in her email about the branches being damaged. Mm-hmm. Now, something like a stoat, it's not going to be able to carry away a feeder. It's not going to damage the branches. I've never heard of a stoat even going to a bird feeder. So we can rule that out. I'd say pine marten is unlikely. They're very agile too. It sounds to me if the branches were broken below, it's something that's a bit more clumsy, a bit less adept in trees. I think a badger isn't a bad guess at all. It could be a fox potentially as well that would take it. I have seen feeders taken by crows, literally unhooked and carried away. But then again, of course, they don't need to break the branches to do that. They fly in from the top and fly away with it.
It's another one of those great mysteries, Niall and Richard and Michelle. So if you get evidence, a photograph will solve this mystery. So you can email Mooney at rte.ie. Now, I have an email here. It's all about an abseiling slug. And it comes in from Jen Wallace, Myrtleville in County Cork. And she says, abseiling slug? We spotted this abseiling slug on our wildlife cam in Cork. She sent in a video. You can see it on our website, rte.ie/Mooney. She goes on, we've never seen anything like it before. And our local wildlife expert suggested we contact you, as he hadn't seen it before either. We'd love to know what your experts think. There is a clip below, but we have more footage either side of the clip. Jen Wallace, Myrtleville in County Cork. Well, I had a look at it, Jen, and I can tell you on it because I responded to you straight away. I had heard of this. In fact, I had actually seen it before, not for real, but I'd seen it on video. But we found a man who knows all about it. His name is Dr. Roy Anderson. He lives in Belfast and he's one of Ireland's leading authorities on slugs.
Hello, my name's Roy Anderson. I'm an amateur person who is very interested in invertebrates. The very first thing I started with was snails, and that moved on to slugs. So I've been looking at slugs for the last 50 years, and it has resulted in the publication of this book here, which is The Slugs of Britain and Ireland. And it updates our knowledge of slugs. Slugs are not that well known. We thought there was about 32 species in Ireland, but we now realise there's approximately 38 species. And in Britain, the change in numbers from this study that was undertaken from about 2011 to 2014 increased the number of slugs in Britain and Ireland from about 33 to 47. So it's quite a big difference. So we've learned a lot more about slugs, and I'm sure there's a lot more to learn as well. The behaviour, breeding habits, and so on are fairly well documented, but there's always more to learn. Mm-hmm. And nowadays it's moved, of course, into the molecular realm. Work is being done on the DNA of these slugs, and we're finding out even more species and how they behave in Ireland and elsewhere in Europe.
That's great news for a person like you and other people who are interested in slugs. I always thought a slug was a slug. I'm surprised you're telling me there are 32 species in Ireland.
38.
38 species. Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, yeah,
so do they look very different?
Some look different, but quite a few look similar to each other. There are groups of slugs which can be quite hard to interpret for the average person as to which species they're looking at. Mm. And some indeed which you have to do a dissection to look at the knotty bits inside to understand what you're dealing with.
Now, when you say what you're dealing with, you're talking about the reproductive organs.
Yeah. Slugs have got both male and female parts. Mm. And so when slugs mate, they exchange sperm bags or spermatheci. And this exchange can take anywhere from 10 minutes to 2 to 3 hours, depending on the species.
Is there any such thing then as a male and a female slug?
No. Slugs are he-she. Yeah. Yeah, they've got both bits. And some slugs don't sexually reproduce. They produce fertile eggs in their own bodies. And that is called selfing. But the majority of species cross. That is, they exchange sperm bags or spermatheci, and you get cross-fertilisation occurring in that. For cross-fertilisation would be a more sustainable approach to parenting in any group of animals. Selfing tends to occur at the edges of ranges of various species where they're not under particular pressure from other competing species, and that, of course, occurs to some of our commonest slugs in Ireland, such as the great black slug, which is abundant on heathlands and in the mountains almost to the summits across Ireland.
What exactly is a slug?
A slug is a mollusk, which is a group of animals with a very wide range of appearance and attributes, ranging from giant squid through octopus to snails, both land and freshwater, and slugs. Slugs, if you want to think of it that way, are snails that have lost their shells. Most slugs have the remnants of a shell internally in the mantle, and if you dissect them, you can find these little fragments of shell still there. Some slugs retain a tiny shell on the outside, and we call those semi-slugs because they're sort of halfway between slugs and snails. And we have four species of semi-slug in Ireland. Three of them are earthworm feeding and occur in southern counties and belong to a genus called Testacella. And the fourth one has just arrived. It's called Dodibardia rufa, and it comes from continental Europe. And like many of our slug species, has been introduced accidentally by man. Of the 38 species of slug found in Ireland, I would say the vast majority are not native. They are introduced. They've come here with plant products and agriculture. Most of them are relatively harmless, but there are a few, particularly one that's come in quite recently, which are major pests of certain types of crops in Europe. Mm. So much so that in Austria, for instance, if you're trying to sell a house, you have to certify that a slug called Orion vulgaris is absent from the property. It's a bit like trying to sell a property which has got Japanese knotweed in it.
Absolutely, yeah, yeah.
So it's taken very seriously there. We do have Orion vulgaris in Ireland now. It's come in within the last 15 years. It's spreading rapidly. But so far, I haven't heard of any reports of severe damage to crops.
We have to ask you about this mucus and these abseiling slugs, the image of which we've posted on our website because it was sent in by one of our listeners. Have you ever heard of this before? Have you ever seen it before with your own eyes?
I haven't seen it with my own eyes. I'd love to see it, but I haven't. There's only one species of slug that does this, though, and that's the tiger slug, Limax maximus. And we have exported, as agriculturalists and so on, Limax maximus across the world from Australia, New Zealand to California. And there was a very interesting series on garden life in Australia about 7 or 8 years ago, and it showed a beautiful rendering of the mating activity of the tiger slug, Larix maximus, where two come together on the underside of a branch. They evert their pinnies. Their pinnies are almost the length of her own body, which is about 4 to 5 inches. These pinnies are averted and circle round each other, form a almost like a Gordian knot, hanging down below the animal, and the animal secretes an enormous amount of mucus, which forms a rope from the solid support, which is a branch or something similar, and they hang down while reproduction is taking place. Now, the mucus rope, if you like, supporting all this activity, must be incredibly strong, because these are not particularly lightweight animals. So it's interesting, as I've learned quite recently, that some American firm has maximized this by working out what the structure of the mucus in the rope is and using it for other applications.
So are you suggesting then that the tiger slug is a native species to Ireland?
It is, yes, as far as we know. A lot of the other species are not native. Most of them have come in quite recently from Britain or near parts of the continent, but two species in particular appear to have a rather longer history in Ireland than appearances might suggest. One is well known, the Kerry slug, and the other not so well known, the flagellate slug. But both occur naturally in northwest Iberia, i.e. northern Spain and northern Portugal. And the thought is that, along with a lot of other things, the very earliest farmers to come to Ireland from northern Spain brought with them various agricultural bits and pieces, and with those, accidentally introduced these two slugs to Ireland at a very early date. DNA evidence suggests that the Kerry slug, for instance, arose from a single introduction in the county of Kerry around 8,000 years ago. So it's been with us a very long time. It's not a native, but I think you'd have to agree it's an honorary native. And it's much commoner in Ireland than it now is in its native homeland in northern Iberia.
And it's probably the most famous slug in Ireland too, for lots of reasons.
It is, because it was included in European legislation, the Habitats Directive, which safeguards it in Ireland from being impinged upon by human activity. And so, of course, if you're planning to build a new road or whatever, you have to take that into account and do the relevant surveys and make sure that the slug is not unduly impacted by the development.
But back to our tiger slug and slugs in general, why do they produce mucus in the first place?
And mucus is used in locomotion, basically provides an interface between the wet, soft slug and a hard substratum. And the mucus is produced for several reasons. First of all, to glide smoothly over the substratum, but also, and this is very important for the point of view of survival, to find its way back to its hiding place once it's finished feeding. And if there's heavy rain, slugs, like worms, lose their way because the mucus is washed off. They can't find their way back.
Is there a scent in that mucus?
I wouldn't describe it as a scent, but there's certainly something like a pheromone that would tell the slug, this is mine, this is my rope, this is my ladder back to my hiding place, and I will follow it once I've finished feeding.
So it's incredibly important for its survival.
It is, yeah.
Yeah.
The colour of mucus is actually used, because it's on the sole, the foot sole of the slug, can actually be used to distinguish different species, because some species have got quite colourless mucus, others have an orange colour, and so on.
Well, right, perhaps you'll see it someday.
Perhaps I will. Maybe this will inspire me to go out with a torch, annoy the neighbours, and see if I can find one in my local vicinity here.
Right, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.
We'll put details of Roy's book on our website, rte.ie/Mooney. Niall, you're nodding at me. Have you seen this?
Would you believe I saw it just last week in Spain? I hadn't seen it before and I've just seen it. So it's very, very topical for me now at the moment. There are two very large, bright yellow slugs. I'd never seen a slug so yellow before. But the two of them were intertwined, hanging down off a branch in a very arid area, were intertwined. And actually, they were writhing around at each other. And they are hermaphrodites. So which they're both male and female sexual organs. So it's a very strange arrangement.
Exactly, quite alien, as Roy was describing, he-she's. Yeah. Both of them are he-she's.
That's right, absolutely. And I was actually amazed in Spain how many slugs there were. Many different species, even in very dry areas, coming across on the ground, or had to be very careful not to step on them as we were walking around. It really brought home to me just how prevalent slugs are, how many species there are, and how much I still have to learn about them.
Now, lizard or not, here's another email from Damien. He says, my sons Dara and Rory and I went down to Cashel on Thursday the 15th of February. We visited my brother's house to visit the boys' cousins and aunts. While out investigating the garden, Dara and his cousin Katie found a strange creature. Please find attached some pictures of their new friend, which you can see on our website. It goes on, I placed the lizard, he calls it, on my hand, and after about a minute, it started to move. Maybe the heat from my hand gave him some energy to move. We placed it back under the block of wood where it was found. Later, when they checked, the lizard had vanished. And it's a lovely picture. And I suppose if you're to look at it at first sight, you might think to yourself, well, it must be a lizard. But is it when you take a closer look? And well, to me, it didn't quite have all the features that the common lizard, we've only got one lizard in Ireland, has. I looked at some images and pictures and books and all that kind of stuff. But the specialist is a man called Rob Gandoli. You heard him on the programme last week with Terry Flanagan trying to figure out how the frog got into the rear taillight in Adrian Kennedy's car. But he joins us again. Rob, you're an expert in these areas. You've seen the picture. What is it?
Yeah, so Damien sent us in this fantastic picture that, he thought they discovered lizards in his brother's garden. What it turns out to be is that the kids actually found one of our native smoothnecks, which is Ireland's only tailed amphibian, which is a member of the salamander family. So, you know, where people get these charismatic yellow and black salamanders that you get on the continent of Europe. But smoothnecks are our only representative in Ireland, on the entire island, that we have of that particular family group.
So it's not a lizard. Now, tell me why it's not a lizard. Can you describe the differences?
Yeah, so the main difference is that it's an amphibian, so it won't have scales. All reptiles will have scales, so that includes lizards. There's also differences in numbers of digits on the hands and on the feet as well. But the big difference really is that newts, in most cases, and especially with our ones, is that they have to go back to water to breed, whereas lizards breed on land. Female smooth newts are incredible animals. They can lay up to 600 eggs. They wrap them individually with their hind feet in pond weed or leaf litter in the pond or whatever, but it's all done underwater. They're incredible little beasts. This time of year, the males turn quite spotty, so it's all to show off to the girls. They have this lovely golden orange belly that is kind of with this dispersed black dots all over it as well. And they engage in an incredible courtship display called the wiggle dance to attract the attention of the female smooth newts. And there's all sort of elaborate interplays for the male to know that the female smooth is actually interested in them.
Oh, tell me about the wiggle dance. Sounds interesting.
It's one of the best things you'll ever see if you're looking into a pond. So the males sit in the water column. So if you can imagine, they're as close to standing upright as you can. So the head is towards the surface of the water and the tail is kind of just below and bent in front of them. And what they're doing is they're emitting pheromones from their cloaca and they waft the pheromones towards the female smooth newt with their tail. So they're wiggling like crazy to push these pheromones through the water column to get to the female smooth newt. And she can use these pheromones then to determine how good of a prospective father this particular male smooth newt is to her unfertilized eggs at this stage. And if she thinks he's worth the, if his juice is worth the squeeze, she'll go up and swim up behind him and she'll touch him with her nose. And then he'll move forward. And if she follows, he'll stop and do another wiggle. And she'll follow again and touch him again and he'll follow. And this kind of repeats itself until she's determined that this guy is the Mac Daddy and he's sufficiently happy that he's got her wrapped, you know, around his little finger due to his, you know, prowess on the dance floor. And then he will lay a sperm packet on the bottom of the pond, and then the female newt will walk above it and she will fertilize herself with this sperm packet. So it's completely different to what frogs are doing, where there's amplexus, which is where the male frog jumps on the back of the female frog and holds on for dear life and then encourages her / squeezes her to release her spawn. Smooth newts, it's all hands off. It's all done individually. But it is very vigorous, and you can see why things like frog tadpoles are a big item on the menu this time of the year, and frog eggs, because dancing 24/7 is an extremely energetic exercise and obviously metabolically very expensive.
I remember watching Britain's Got Talent some years ago, and there was a guy on, he got the golden buzzer. I can't remember his name, but the song was Wiggle and Wine or Wiggle Way. I'll find it, I'll stick it in. Now I know what he was singing about. Anyway, Richard.
Rob, I believe that newts hibernate in woodpiles and under logs. People hardly ever see newts because they're nocturnal and they're aquatic and so forth. But going to a woodpile in the winter, you might suddenly find one. And of course, it was seen as dark and mysterious. The Alt Lucre of my childhood was supposed to go into your mouth when you were asleep, down into your stomach and eat all your food. Now, is there any truth in this? Why is it on the dark side? The world of animals is divided into the goodies and the baddies. And unfortunately, this lovely, harmless creature tends to be put in the baddies. Can you comment on that?
I can indeed. And it's one of these Irish mythological kind of old wives' tales that I absolutely love. So this is where the idea of the man keeper or the man creeper, as newts are sometimes known as. And like you said, they're supposed to crawl into the mouth of, usually it's a male, and they climb down into his stomach, and then he suffers from wasting disease because the newt's eating all of his food, right? So he's getting no nutrition at all. And this is generally a common occurrence when there was men who fell asleep out on the bog, whether they were cutting turf or they were acting the giddy goat and they didn't want to go home in a certain condition to the wife. But the cure is brilliant. Apparently, the cure to get the newt back out was you had to put a lovely piece of bacon in front of your mouth or have it strapped to your head and dangle it in front of your mouth. And this would encourage the newt to climb up your esophagus and come out of your mouth because it made him hungry and or it made him very thirsty, obviously, because of the salt content. It's complete nonsense, but it's absolutely fantastic.
The witches in Macbeth are mixing their brew, and it's the eye of newt and the toe of frog, wool of bat and tongue of dog. But actually, they're the names of common plants. But they are, you have that same dark association with witness there. So it's not just an Irish thing. Is there anything to fear from newts, in fact?
Absolutely not. So not only are they an incredible member of our native fauna, they also should be the good guys because they do something that sometimes maybe they might get in trouble and seem to be masters of the dark arts. But because they're members of the salamander family, they have an incredible ability to regenerate. So a lovely lady in Tipperary sent me photographs once about, it must be nearly 2 years ago now, and she had found a smooth newt in the garden who had either been damaged by a strimmer or by a corvid or something anyway. But this particular newt had extensive trauma and scarring to the head and his eye. And she didn't want to let him go back into the garden because he was hurt. So I just said, well, take photographs, put him somewhere safe with some soil and leaf litter and monitor how he progresses. And over the next 2 months or so, the skin started to repair itself. The eye actually repaired itself. Now, it wasn't able to grow back the full eye, but it did regrow the eye stalk, and you could see this in the photographs. So, it was brilliant. So this lady, Patricia, named this particular new Bilbo, as in from Lord of the Rings and The Hobbit, because obviously the ring was able to keep him alive for a long, long time. So Bilbo became a bit of a celebrity within the herpetological society because we were watching him regrow his skin and watch his muscles stitch back together and everything else. I don't know, does that make them a goodie? I think it does. Because if you look at their distant relatives in Mexico, the axolotls, they're being studied extensively because they can regenerate everything from limbs to hearts to brains to spinal cords. Absolutely incredible animals with huge medical potential for people. So, you know, I would say that smooth newts are the goodies in the overall scheme of things.
And that's exactly what the picture is of, a smooth newt, correct?
Yeah, it absolutely is, yeah.
Well, Rob, thank you very much indeed. We knew you would be the man to talk to. We'll talk to you soon, Rob. Bye.
Thanks, kindly. See you, lads. Bye-bye.
And that's pretty much all we have time for. My thanks to Niall Hatch and Richard Collins, to Terry Flanagan, our broadcast coordinator, Daniel Keating, and our researcher, Michelle Brown. And, of course, Rob Gandola. And we will leave you with that performance, well, part of it, from Britain's Got Talent. Here is Donchez singing Wiggle Wine. See you next week. Bye.
Wiggle Wine, girl. You are on the world.